From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
I want to ask you what has happened to a country whose political objectives must be secured at the end of a bayonet.
Today, remembering the legendary anti-war warrior Dave Dellinger, with Tom Hayden, Leonard Wineglass, Dan Berrigan, Howard Zinn, and our own Jeremy Scahill.
The world has lost one of the greatest nonviolent revolutionaries of our times. Dave Dellinger was like America's Gandhi.
And a new documentary called Preventive Warriors.
Their idea of an American century is very frightening. It's the domination of the world by a single power. It's essentially the creation of a new empire for 100, 200 years, where anything that dissents, anything that moves against this empire is crushed.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, a ceasefire may be emerging in Najaf between Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr and the United States. According to one of Sadr's aides, he is now offering to withdraw and disarm his militia from Najaf under the condition that the U.S. pull its troops from the holy city and for criminal charges against him to be dropped. A senior official in the Shiite Dawah Party confirmed that a preliminary agreement has been reached. The deal comes less than a day after U.S. forces arrested one of Sadr's top lieutenants, Riyad al-Nouri, in a pre-dawn raid Wednesday. Members of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council traveled to Najaf today to help finalize the truce. Three Shiite members of the council announced they would stage a sit-in at a mosque in nearby Kufa until the U.S. troops leave the city. We go now to Najaf for a report from independent filmmaker James Longley. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, good to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Can you explain what has just taken place? What is emerging out of the news conference you attended?
Well, to me, it's still a little bit sketchy exactly what's happened, but it looks like what's taking place is really a unilateral ceasefire, which is being offered to the American forces, and to see whether or not they will take it. Because if you listen to the way it was presented, it really seems as though they're saying, this is what we are willing to offer if, you know, our conditions are met, and we'll see what happens. There were some journalists inside the press conference that just ended about half an hour ago from the French newspaper Libération, who said that they had been to the United States military base earlier this morning, which is in between Najaf and Kufa, and that they had spoken with the Americans, and the Americans said they didn't really know the details of what was being brokered, that they were not really a direct party to it, that this was perhaps something that Chalabi was organizing. It wasn't clear exactly. So they also said, though, that they were considering the issuing of a statement about the ceasefire offer. So it's not a done deal 100%, because this is apparently not something which has been hammered out between the Muqtada Sadr militia or the Muqtada Sadr office and the American forces, but rather something which is being offered to see whether or not the Americans will go for it.
Independent filmmaker James Longley reporting from Najaf. UN officials are accusing the Bush administration of trying to undermine the work of UN envoy Lakhdar Brahimi in Iraq by leaking the name of a possible new Iraqi prime minister. U.S. officials had said on Tuesday a former nuclear scientist named Hussein Sherestani, who's jailed under Saddam Hussein, was the leading contender for the post. But UN officials deny the reports. The scientist himself announced Wednesday he's not interested in the position. In other Iraq news, some members of the Iraqi governing council have rejected President Bush's call to level the notorious Abu Ghraib prison because they describe the destruction as a waste of resources. Meanwhile, New York Times reports the military has gleaned little intelligence from prisoners held at Abu Ghraib. In a major speech Wednesday, former Vice President Al Gore called for the resignations of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, and the Director of Central Intelligence George Tenet. Gore said, quote, "We simply can't afford to further increase the risk to our country with more blunders by this team." Gore also said three of Rumsfeld's deputies should also resign, Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Douglas Feith, and Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence Stephen Cambone. Attorney General John Ashcroft announced the formation of the 2004 Threat Task Force to deal with the possibility of another major attack by al-Qaeda on U.S. soil. He said, quote, "Credible intelligence from multiple sources indicates al-Qaeda plans to mount an attack on the U.S. in the next few months. This disturbing intelligence indicates al-Qaeda's specific intention to hit the U.S. hard," he said. The government did not elevate the terror threat level. The U.S. government released the names and photos of seven suspects, six of whom have been on wanted lists before. The one new person is an American named Yahya Adam Gadan, who grew up on a goat ranch in California, converted to Islam after a period when he was obsessed with heavy metal music, they say. The government claims the man attended an al-Qaeda training camp. And a new report by the International Institute for Strategic Studies concludes that the occupation of Iraq has helped al-Qaeda recruit new members. The think tank estimated there are potentially 18,000 members of al-Qaeda around the world. Israeli police have arrested the British reporter who exposed Israel's nuclear weapons program 2 decades ago when he secured an exclusive interview with nuclear whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu. In the article in the Sunday Times of London, Vanunu exposed details confirming Israel had a secret nuclear weapons program. This led Israel to the arrest and imprisonment of Vanunu for 18 years. He was released a month ago. Now Israel's arrested the journalist behind the piece, Peter Hunam, who traveled to Israel more than a month ago ahead of Vanunu's release and was working on a documentary for BBC about Vanunu. The government's placed a gag order on all information about Peter Hunam's arrest. According to the London Independent, Hunam's arrest only became known to the public because he was briefly able to break away from the arresting officers to tell someone in his hotel what happened. He grabbed the hair of a female guest in the hotel lobby to get her attention and said, quote, "Tell people, tell the Sunday Times that I'm being arrested." Hunam's lawyer said, quote, "The man was arrested without reason out of a ceaseless security obsession with Vanunu." The arrest may have come because the Sunday Times is planning to run this weekend the first major extensive interview with Vanunu since his release. And the Financial Times reports the U.S. is looking for help from private companies because it's running out of bullets. The military owns a single ammunition factory in Lake City, Missouri, but the war on Iraq is quickly draining the supply. The military estimates it needs between 300 and 500 million more bullets a year. One defense analyst said, quote, "We're using so much ammunition in Iraq, there isn't enough capacity around." And in Haiti and the Dominican Republic, massive floods and landslides have led to the death of nearly 2,000 people over the last few days. The death toll skyrocketed Wednesday when more than 1,000 bodies were found in a single town, Mapu, in southeastern Haiti.
Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look how we won with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore.
For I march to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men, and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us.
Phil Oakes, I Ain't Marching Anymore. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, I'm Amy Goodman. America's lost one of the great nonviolent activists of the past century. Dave Dellinger died on Tuesday at a nursing home in Montpelier, Vermont. According to friends, he was suffering from Alzheimer's disease. Dellinger lost track of the number of times he was arrested or jailed over the years for protests, including demonstrations against the Vietnam War. Through the decades, Dave Dellinger was a stalwart in nonviolent protest beside the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Daniel Berrigan, Daniel Ellsberg, other leaders. But he probably is best known for being one of those on trial in Chicago after the 1968 Democratic Convention. Dave Dellinger was in his mid-50s at the time, the old man of the group of radicals who faced prison after the anti-war protests during the convention. While the Chicago 8 trial gained Dellinger the most notoriety, it was just one event in a long time of fighting for what he believed was right.
Our position is that whoever the candidates are and whatever the platforms, that we must stay in the streets and stay in active resistance, or else there will be no peace, either in the ghettos or in Vietnam.
Dave Dellinger, speaking in the 1960s. We're joined now by our own Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent and producer, and on the line, historian Howard Zinn. Jeremy, your thoughts. You knew Dave Dellinger well.
Actually, it's interesting to hear that bit of sound of Dave Dellinger, because that was recorded during the trial of the Chicago 8, where they were on trial for conspiracy because of the protests organized around the 1968 Democratic Convention. And when I really got to know Dave Dellinger was at the 1996 Democratic Convention, also in Chicago. And a group of us went to the Federal Building in downtown Chicago, among them Dave Dellinger and Abby Hoffman's son. And we were arrested. We were engaged in a peaceful demonstration about political prisoners. And toward the end of Dave's life, that really was one of the main issues in his life. Worked diligently to try to free the Native American political prisoner Leonard Peltier. Worked on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, on prisoners of the Puerto Rican liberation struggle. He was really dedicated to that issue of political prisoners. Dave Dellinger was one of the moral giants of our time, one of the framers of modern pacifist resistance theory. One of the extraordinary things I think about him, and his book, Revolutionary Nonviolence, which is his writings from World War II to 1970, I think has to be one of the greatest books on nonviolence ever written. And it's his series of essays. It's really like a journalist travels around the world. And the thing about Dave Dellinger is that he didn't believe in armchair pacifism. He didn't believe that you could be a pacifist between wars. He was in Europe as a student when the Franco Rebellion broke out, the first front in the fight against fascism, as a young college student. He then was a conscientious objector in World War II and spent 3 years in prison. He was in Cuba shortly after the revolution. He was in Vietnam many times. And I'm sure Howard Zinn can talk about that as well. Dave Dellinger, like Howard, was involved with negotiating the release of American prisoners of war. But the reason that I bring up all of these examples is because Dave Dellinger also was very critical of the left in America, and particularly critical of armchair pacifism. Dave Dellinger believed that if you have a problem with the people of Cuba rising up violently to overthrow a dictatorship backed by the United States, then you need to go to Cuba and be nonviolent yourself. If you believe that the North Vietnamese have no right to resist the United States, then you need to go to North Vietnam and be nonviolent yourself. And that, I think, was the extraordinary example of Dave Dellinger.
Historian Howard Zinn on the line with us. Your thoughts?
Well, it was very, very sad, of course, to hear about Dave Dellinger, but, you know, he inspired us all. I met him first in Hiroshima in 1966, and that was typical of him, you know, flying halfway around the world to be part of an international gathering to remember the dropping of the bomb. I mean, all of his life, he really struggled against war. I mean, it's interesting. I was in World War II. I was a bombardier in World War II. I wasn't thinking about pacifism or war or, you know, I was imbued like everybody else with the idea of a good war. Dave Dellinger saw beyond that, that he saw farther than that. He was a conscientious objector in World War II. And not that he didn't understand the dangers of fascism, but he thought it was necessary to uphold the ideal of nonviolent resistance to fascism, to war. You know, and of course, I was on many platforms with Dave many times during the Vietnam War. He briefed me and Dan Berrigan before we went to Hanoi in 1968. I went to testify for him and the others in the Chicago conspiracy trial. He was an absolute rock of integrity, and all through his life. And he never made any money. You know, he's always struggling. He never held any post. He's not like some of us, you know, professors in universities and getting salaries. He never drew that. He just always lived at the edge of poverty. And he was always, even after he was supposedly retired, I remember I thought he was retired and living in Vermont, and I went to Columbus, Ohio. And there he was on Columbus Day, engaged in a fast at the foot of the Statue of Columbus, protesting on behalf of indigenous people against the idea that conquest, as which Columbus represented, was a good thing. But, you know, Dave, among his other books, wrote a book called More Power Than We Know. I thought that was important because he was always conscious of the fact that the people, if they organize, if they persist, have more power than we know, that it always looks like an impossible battle against the establishment with all their weapons and all their money. But he understood, and history bears him out, that when enough people get together and organize and take risks, do the kinds of things that Dave did all his life, they can overcome the most powerful military machine on earth.
Howard Zinn, I want to thank you very much for being with us as we turn now to other reminiscences of the anti-war warrior Dave Dellinger, beginning with Tom Hayden.
I was on trial with Dave Dellinger in 1969 and 1970 as part of the so-called Chicago Eight. Our trial arose out of the Nixon administration's attempt to suppress the anti-war movement. And I thought I would just read a couple of excerpts from my notes on the trial that I think capture Dave's pacifism. He was a rock. He was much older than us. Of course, I'm older than he is now, but he had turned 60 and was the old man of the trial. And now I'm reading. The winter days blurred into each other. The judge ordered us to continue the case on Saturdays, and our frustration grew as February and the end of the trial approached. There was one more vindictive insult to withstand, the revocation of Dave Dellinger's bail. As the trial unfolded, Dave had gradually lost his patience. Either from despair or a Quaker sense of direct action, he began reacting vocally, often eloquently, at outrages in the courtroom. Sometimes the situation was really absurd, as when the judge ordered us to go to the bathroom in an adjoining cell instead of the public facility in the hall. Jerry Rubin and the prosecutors got into a heated argument with each other over the bathroom, and the federal marshals moved in. Dave said, "Don't touch him," and was ordered by the marshals to shut up. Dave replied, hurt, "You don't have to say shut up." At other times, it would grow out of frustration. On January 14th, for example, the judge erroneously accused Dave of saying something, to which Dave replied, "That's a lie." The judge, aroused, declared that he had never sat in 50 years through a trial where a party to a lawsuit called a judge a liar. That stirred Dave's deepest convictions, and he rose up and said, maybe they were afraid to go to jail rather than tell the truth, but I would rather go to jail for however long you send me than to let you get away with that kind of thing. And second, on the day of our convictions, Abbie Hoffman had said, we're going to win every day until the last, but we were convicted for contempt of court, and it was later overthrown. But the judge started with Dave Dellinger, finding him in contempt 32 times, a sentence of 2 years, 5 months, and 16 days. Mr. Dellinger, do you care to say anything? The judge said, I will hear you only in respect to punishment. Dave rose slowly, already tired from 2 weeks in the county jail. He tried to reply to the specific findings of the judge, but was stopped by the command to speak only to mitigate his punishment. Dave reacted sharply, suddenly gaining an eloquence that he wanted for the final statement. He said, you want us to be like good Germans supporting the evils of our decade, and then when we refused to be good Germans and came to Chicago, now you want us to be like good Jews going quietly and politely to the concentration camps while you and this court suppress freedom and the truth. And the fact is, I'm not prepared to do that. The marshals started moving in on Dave at the judge's instructions. You want us to stay in our place like black people were supposed to stay in their place, like poor people were supposed to stay in their place, like women are supposed to stay in their place, like people without formal education are supposed to stay in their place, and children are supposed to stay in their place, and lawyers are supposed to stay in their place. The marshals came closer, grabbing Dave's arms. People will no longer be quiet. People are going to speak up. I am an old man. And I am speaking feebly and not too well, but I reflect the spirit that will echo throughout the world. Take him out, the judge commanded. There was an uproar in the spectator section, and I saw Dave's 15-year-old daughter, Michelle, red-faced, screaming, a crying tiger being held around the throat by a marshal. Dave tried to move toward her. Both were held from each other by a dozen marshals. Everybody in the courtroom was standing. Reporters were crying. Bill Kunstler collapsed over the lectern and asked to be punished next. That's my memory of Dave, and he certainly was able to turn nonviolence into a source of fiery resistance.
Tom Hayden, one of the leaders of the Students for a Democratic Society and co-defendant with Dave Dellinger of the Chicago 8 conspiracy trial. We'll have more reminiscences from Dan Berrigan and others in just a minute here on Democracy Now!
And the night comes again to the circle-studded sky. The stars settle slowly, in loneliness they lie. Till the universe explodes as a falling star is raised. Planets are paralyzed, the mountains are amazed. But they all glow brighter from the brilliance of the blade. With the speed of insanity, then he died. In the green fields of turning, baby is born. His cries crease the wind, mingle with the morn. An assault upon the order, the changing of the guard. Chosen for a challenge that is hopelessly hard. And the only single sign is the sighing of the stars. But to the silence of distance, they are sworn.
Phil Oak singing The Crucifixion here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report as we continue to remember Dave Dellinger.
My name is Len Wineglass. I was one of the attorneys of the Chicago 8 trial. And I've known Dave for 35 years, since the 1968 Democratic Convention protest. When I think of Dave and his loss, I think of the statement that Adlai Stevenson made at the funeral of Eleanor Roosevelt when he said, we've lost more than a friend, we've lost an inspiration. And Dave was that for me and for many of us. I recall so many things over the years, but one of my most vivid recollections is during the trial of the Chicago Eight, when Bobby Seale was gagged and bound and taped to a chair. Dave immediately suggested to the other defendants that they absent themselves from the courtroom because it would just be obscene for the seven white defendants to remain quietly in the courtroom while Bobby Seale, the leader of the black liberation struggle, was bound and gagged in that condition. Everyone readily agreed to that, but then were overruled by Bobby Seale, who said that they should come to court and sit there quietly for two reasons. First, if they refused to come to court, they would all be jailed. And it was important that they be free to travel the country and to speak to what they had observed going on in the courtroom. And secondly, it was important that the focus be on a black defendant in a federal court insisting on his rights as a citizen to represent himself and being bound and gagged as a result of that. And if the remaining seven were also arrested, there would be a lack of focus on that issue. And Dave and the other seven readily agreed and came to court the next day. Dave has always taken positions like that that are highly principled, always willing to put himself on the line for what he considered to be a politically essential and necessary stand that ought to be taken. And Judge Hoffman in the Chicago Eight trial learned that right away. Dave came to court. He was older than everyone else by probably 25 years. He wore a jacket and a tie, and he sat there. But when Judge Hoffman came into the courtroom, he refused to rise. And he was immediately questioned by Judge Hoffman about that. And Dave said to him that he doesn't accord false respect. That respect is something that must be earned. And he certainly didn't feel that Judge Hoffman had earned his respect. And of course, Dave was sentenced to prison for contempt of court as a result of that stand. So he's always been that way, and he's always been our stable voice, our inspiration, our person who's always been there for every issue that's come down since 1968. And of course, he was there long before that, but since I've known him. And we're going to miss Dave very, very much. If anything, we need Dave Dellinger now more than ever.
My name is Ralph Pigia, and I work at the War Resistance League. I've been here a very long time, and I know this is about my dear friend, David. I met David in World War II. I met him in prison. David was a conscience objector, and he was a seminarian, and he could have gotten off by just saying that he was a seminarian. He could have been exempt, but he and six or seven others, refused to do that, and they were eventually sentenced to prison for not registering for the draft. Anyway, here's how I met David. I also had, was an objector, and I was sent to prison for 3 years, and I went to Danbury first, and then I was transferred to Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, where I met David. And my first meeting with David was this. I was with a group of people who were on strike, refusing to work, and we were being held in a certain cell block where there were the so-called tough guys. And one incident that someone came to me, one of the, these so-called tough guys, I came to me and said, listen, you guys are making it tough for us in prison here because the guards are always around, and if you don't get out of here, you're going to be in trouble. And then he walked away, so I was a little upset about that. But anyway, the next morning, someone came up to my cell and said, are you a friend of Dave Dellinger's? And, of course, I never had met Dave, but I certainly knew all about him, so I said, yes. He said, well, listen, any friend of David is a friend of mine. So he said, if anything happens to you, you let me know and we'll take care of it. Now, this fellow was not a pacifist, but he was a friend of David's, and I still hadn't met David. And I found out later that the reason this non-pacifist, his regular prisoner, had come to me because David had very often supported people who had gotten in trouble, and he, you know, stood up for them. You know, most of the COs stood up for each other, you know, because we worked together, but he stood up for the other prisoners also, and he was well liked by other prisoners, and that was because of his compassion for all people, not just conscientious objectors. Anyway, that was my first meeting with. I hadn't even met him yet, but that was my first contact with David. That was the kind of thing that showed how he was getting along with other people. So finally, I did meet David, get out into the prison population, and got to know him very well. And David was very dedicated to the peace movement, to the pacifism, and to nonviolence. I think that David would work with other. Sometimes he would work with other groups that weren't involved in the nonviolent movement. But he always worked with anybody who was for, like in the Vietnam War, there were many people who were against the war, but also were not a pacifist. And he worked with many people outside the pacifist movement, but never giving up his ideas of what he believed in, but he did work with them. And I would say his legacy was that David always was for the underdog, and he gave up many things in his life to try to achieve those ideas.
This is Dave McReynolds, formerly worked with Dave Dellinger at Liberation Magazine from 1957 to 1960, but I would primarily be known as the former staff of the Warby Sisters League. I had met Dave for the first time when I came to New York in 1956 to work with Liberation Magazine, which was a radical voice of the pacifist movement. Started in 1956 by A.J. Musty and Bayard Rustin, Sid Peck, Dave Dellinger, and Roy Finch. And it was a fascinating experience to be at the weekly meetings with Dave. This was long before the mass mobilizations of Vietnam or the Chicago trials, for which Dave is more widely known. The board had an interesting breakdown between the anarchists who were Roy Finch and Dave Dellinger and the more Marxist position, which was Sid Lenz, Bayard, and A.J. I think my impression of Dave, I've thought about this over the years, despite some disagreements that I've had at points with Dave, was the extraordinary burden that Dave undertook to raise the funds, get the meetings of the mobilizations for the various Vietnam actions, borrow the money that was needed, open the offices, all of the things which, if you were a president, you'd have a whole staff worrying about and doing.
This is Daniel Berrigan, and I'm reflecting with a certain sense of great loss, or reflecting on the long friendship that I had with David. And I wanted to talk about the last kind of encounter that I had with himself and his wife, Elizabeth. This was in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. And someone had set up a panel in the course of a weekend against war. And the panel, I thought, was very innovative. It consisted of David and Elizabeth on the one side of the stage and Philip's son and daughter, Jerry and Frida, on the other. And the idea was to reflect on generations of peacemaking, where the young people were, where the elders were, and have them even question one another. Well, it turned out to be delightful and charming and certain sorrow about losses even then and losses to come. And it was very beautiful to see the kind of deep listening that the elders did to these young folk as they told about growing up in Jonah House with one or another parent away in prison, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then David and Elizabeth talking about raising their family in the midst of, well, everything from the Second War to Vietnam and on to the nuclear question and so on and so forth. And the mingling was not merely of generations, but it was of sensibility and outlook, and I thought a very deep communality in the crucial matter of nonviolent resistance, with nonviolence underscored. It was also on that occasion that the two youngers came to me very disturbed because they had been talking with their father, who was planning another Plowshares action. And, excuse me, they were shaken with the prospect, not just of losing him once more, but whether or not at that advanced age of his, he was in his later 70s, he might very well die in prison. So I decided to confront them, you know, head on and said, well, everyone that goes at that age takes that kind of chance. And I'm sure that it's on the mind of David Dellinger and his wife about what's the next action and what are the risks involved and what is conscience telling one about that and so on and so forth. Well, my memory of David goes back and back and back. Some of it, of course, is from reading and pondering his autobiography. I thought of the amazing changes that had been brought about in his life because he was so consistent and his conscience was absolutely seamless. We all had a great mentor and friend who could be called upon in almost any direction relative to human decency and peaceableness, and who would fulfill that daring a saying of Gandhi that the peacemaker belongs where the war is, not where the peace is. So David would set out for this or that trouble spot, doing what could be done and daring at times what could not be done. And for this he will be in our memory as long as we live, myself and my family and my friends. God bless him. God rest him.
Dan Berrigan, Dave McReynolds, Ralph DeGia, Leonard Weinglass, Tom Hayden Howardson, remembering Dave Dellinger as we end with the words of Dave Dellinger, read by Democracy Now!'s Jeremy Scahill.
And this is from an essay he wrote upon the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 called Declaration of War. The way of life that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki and is reported to have roasted alive up to 1 million people in Tokyo in a single night is international and dominates every nation of the world. But we live in the United States, so our struggle is here. With this way of life, death would be more appropriate. There can be no truce nor quarter. The prejudices of patriotism, the pressures of our friends, and the fear of unpopularity, imprisonment, or death should not hold us back any longer. It must be total war against the infamous economic, political, and social system which is dominant in this country. The American system has been destroying human life in peace and in war, at home and abroad, for decades. Now it has produced the growing infamy of atom bombing. Beside these brutal facts, the tidbits of token democracy mean nothing. Henceforth, no decent citizen owes one scrap of allegiance, if he ever did, to American law, American custom, or American institutions.
Jeremy Scahill reading the words of Dave Dellinger from Revolutionary Nonviolence. And that does it for this remembrance. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359, or go to our website at democracynow.org. Coming up, we bring you an excerpt of a new documentary called Preventive Warriors. Stay with us.
There's no place in this world where I'll belong when I'm gone. And I won't know the right from the wrong when I'm gone. And you won't find me singing on this song when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't feel the flowing of the time when I'm gone. All the pleasures of love will not be mine when I'm gone. My pen won't pour a lyric line when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't breathe the bracing air when I'm gone. And I can't even worry about my cares when I'm gone. Won't be asked to do my share when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it
when I'm gone. Phil Oakes here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now to a new documentary. In September 2002, as the Bush administration marked the first anniversary of the September 11th attacks with a push toward an invasion of Iraq, the White House made public a bold new foreign policy paper entitled The National Security Strategy of the United States. The document outlined a radical new doctrine in American foreign policy, one of so-called preemptive warfare. The doctrine was used as the Bush administration's justification for the invasion of Iraq. Proponents say the doctrine is necessary in a world where terrorists might one day get their hands on weapons of mass destruction. Critics say the new doctrine of unilateralism reflects a desire by the U.S. to establish an empire. Today, we bring you an excerpt of the documentary Preventive Warriors, produced by Michael Burns and Greg Anson on Monday, Memorial Day, will premiere the entire program. But today, an excerpt with the featuring leading thinkers and intellectuals of our time, including Noam Chomsky, Chalmers Johnson, Tariq Ali, and more. This is Preventive Warriors. We begin with Anthony Ornoff.
The National Security Strategy of the United States is a document that was released in September of 2002. And what it does is it lays out a position, a framework for what the U.S. seeks to do on the global stage, what its foreign policy objectives are. And what's interesting about the National Security Strategy document is that it puts into language a number of doctrines that the United States has held for many years, but which it's been shy about publicly stating.
It's a doctrine that calls for preemptive war against any nation or combination of countries that, in our opinion,
Chalmers Johnson,
international legitimacy, say, provided by the UN Security Council, that, in our opinion, threatened our interests as a nation, that we then reserve the right to, in the words of the president, take them out, to eliminate them militarily.
The main thrust of the document is to ensure American military dominance for the rest of time.
Michael Clare.
That is the essential objective of the strategy, is never to allow another power to arise that could conceivably challenge the United States as a major power. That is, we always have to remain the number one top power. And there are a lot of elements to that, including military superiority, technological superiority, economic dominance, and much else follows from that.
So in terms of what it means, it's a document that I think has been clearly a guide to the practice of the Bush administration, and it sets out to implement a policy of securing American hegemony, global hegemony, regional hegemony in areas of strategic importance like the Middle East, and it provides a framework for understanding the objectives of the United States today, so I think it's very important.
Now, that's related to something else that I think is distinctive, is the influence of neoconservative thinking on the Bush administration. As I say, the idea of supremacy, of dominance, was long there and was shared by Democrats and Republicans. But this crusading spirit you find in the NSS, the notion that America is sort of chosen by history and destiny to bring its values, democracy and the free markets and all that, to the rest of the world, that must act proactively and assertively to do that. That, I think, reflects the influence of neoconservative thinkers, and you don't find that quite so strong in earlier documents like this.
The national security doctrine is quite explicit. It says what we're going to do. That the Vice President Cheney once spoke of 50 nations that he wanted to carry out regime change in. The president upped him 10 more and said there were 60 of them. That's letting the rest of the world know we're coming. What it means is that all other countries on Earth today are quietly conspiring with each other to prepare to resist the United States. The pattern is exactly the same kind of pattern that developed in the first and second centuries AD against the Roman Empire, which ultimately led to its destruction. So it's hard to imagine a more profound impact that the United States is having on the rest of the world than through the national security doctrine of September 2002.
You know, it says we're not going to tolerate rogue states, we're not going to tolerate terrorists with weapons of mass destruction, we're not going to tolerate the rise of competing powers in the world. We're not going to let that happen. We're going to do whatever it takes to prevent those things from happening. So it's more negative of threats we're not going to allow. It doesn't do a very good job of saying if we follow this path, these are all the benefits that are going to accrue to us. I mean, I suppose you could say we're going to be safer, although I find it very hard, you know, if you analyze it, to see how that's actually going to work. I think it's going to make us more exposed to risk than safer. But it really doesn't spell out very well what benefits we'll have, except, I guess you could say, the preservation of privilege. It does say that we're a very privileged country at a very privileged moment in time, and our purpose here is to preserve our privileges indefinitely.
It has a certain rationality within a kind of a lunatic framework, but that's not so unusual in world affairs.
Over
history, history is just replete with examples, including recent history, of actions that were undertaken by perfectly rational people that carried, as they knew, a severe risk to themselves and their own interests, but were undertaken because of pursuing shorter-term goals of higher priority. History's full of it. Just take a look at the history of wars. I mean, wars are started by somebody. The people who start them very often lose the war and get destroyed, but it doesn't mean it was irrational. In fact, if somebody's watching this whole story from Mars, they would think they're all berserk. No. But within a lunatic framework, it looks not only rational, but laudable. And you can give plenty of other examples, unfortunately.
The rule in the world at the present time, under American guidance, is might makes right. And that makes us extremely dangerous.
Chalmers Johnson.
There are a number of sins, in fact, that you can say with quite good justice and with quite good reason that the United States has committed in recent years, and that the Bush administration in particular is committing. But the question before this House tonight is not whether you would prefer to see a kinder and gentler United States. The question is not whether you would prefer to see Al Gore as president or George Bush. The question is not whether the United States can and should be more prudent in its finances, more prudent in its foreign policy, and in general act more to reassure those with less power in the world than it is currently doing. The question is rather specific. The question is whether United States foreign policy is doing more harm than good. To answer, therefore, in the affirmative, you're saying something very specific and very concrete. You're not saying that you don't like George Bush. You're saying that you think that what George Bush has done and presided over is so bad that it would be better if he hadn't done what he had done. You are saying, therefore, that you are siding, rather objectively in the old Marxist terminology, with those who are his enemies. However unpleasant and ridiculous that kind of zero-sum thinking is, this House today forces us to consider that very question. You are saying that you'd prefer a world in which Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, and the Taliban are riding high in the saddle to one in which they are on the run, in hiding, and hopefully soon exterminated.
That was Gideon Rose, editor, Foreign Affairs. This is Preventive Warriors, a film by Michael Burns and Greg Anson here on Democracy Now! As we turn now to Rahul Mahajan.
Out of previous documents by the Project for a New American Century, in particular one issued in September 2000 called Rebuilding America's Defenses, which is very important to read because it's like a massively expanded and much more honest version of the national security strategy, and it's interesting to see how they relate. That document itself grows out of a document Paul Wolfowitz wrote in 1992 called the Defense Planning Guidance. This document was laid out the same kind of vision. Basically, the question has been, ever since the end of the Soviet Union, how do the elite planners of the United States take advantage of what they call the unipolar moment? The fact that with the end of the Soviet Union, there is no power on the earth that can really measure up against the United States, and almost none that can even deter the United States in any significant way. And so Wolfowitz's answer was, take advantage of it by an extremely militaristic policy, by an open declaration of military dominance, and by the things that are necessary to go along with it. So Paul Wolfowitz wrote a document which laid these things out in some detail in 1992.
He declared that the policy of the United States should be to prevent any country, anywhere, developing power that could conceivably challenge our interests, not just militarily, but our interests in resources and things of this sort.
When George W. Bush came to office, it effectively became a blueprint for the administration's new foreign policy. And the ideas of Wolfowitz, and they were shared by many others, their ideas very gradually started to become administration policy. And George Bush also took many members of the hawkish neoconservative think tanks to work
Ryan.
In his government and to work as consultants to his government. For example, he took 21 members of the Center for Security Policy from the American Enterprise Institute. There were at least 10 people that went to work for the Bush administration. There were 16 people who had worked with the Project for the New American Century throughout the 90s.
This represents a group of people that have conventionally been called neoconservatives, meaning a new kind of conservative. I don't think they're conservatives at all, new or old. They're radicals, quite serious radicals, committed to the unilateral exercise of military power, of the militarization of the country. They fully accept the militarism that goes with their imperialism, and that these people have bided their time. They obviously did not have the support of the country or the Congress when George Bush was appointed president in 2001. But with the attacks of September 11th, 2001, they have said in so many words, it was their opportunity. It was like Pearl Harbor. It was a chance to take over, and under the cover of a presidentially declared so-called war on terrorism, they began to implement what was a private agenda of their own.
So if you look at detail at all of these documents, you find several different components of this worldview. One, as I said, military technology, total technological supremacy. That's one of the tenets of this new worldview. A second tenet, a dramatic expansion of military bases around the world. And we've seen this carried out since 9/11 in at least a dozen new countries. And the third tenet is wars for regime change, which is to say wars in which the goal is at the end that the United States goes into the country and creates a regime. Regime change doesn't mean bringing democracy. Regime change means we create a government that is a military puppet of the United States that obeys our larger military imperial policy.
In all of these documents, you find sort of an implicit belief, an implicit understanding that the United States has been chosen somehow as the world's leader because of our history or our superior values Or for some of these people who are deeply religious, we've been chosen by Almighty God to be the world's leader and to bring our values to the rest of the world, that we're different from other people, that the political science term is exceptionalism, that we've been granted an exemption from the laws that we insist that everybody else follows because we're chosen, we're the preferred people, and therefore we have the right to act as the world superpower, the world police power, that we've been chosen for this task. I do believe that this mode of thinking is deeply embedded in the Bush administration and in many of these earlier documents. Now, not everybody would go so far as that, but I do think that everyone in Washington, in the Clinton and the two Bush administrations, and certainly Reagan, does feel that the United States has earned its superpower status and has a right to exercise the concentration of power that we've accumulated over the years, and that it's our obligation to do so. So it's this arrogance that prevails, that pervades everything. All of these documents are driven by this arrogance.
Their idea of an American century is very frightening. It's the domination of the world by a single power. It's essentially the creation of a new empire for 100, 200 years, where anything that dissents, anything that moves against this empire is crushed. And that is not going to bring peace to the world. You know, we have parts of the world which are now directly occupied. And there will be no peace as long as these occupations continue. And if you begin to occupy more regions, there will be more resistance. And the irony is that all these, some liberal dreamers, leaving aside the neocons, who think this is the only way we can sort out the world, do not realize that in the world of today, where there is neoliberalism at home, you can't have enlightened social democracy abroad. That is the dilemma that confronts the empire.
Tariq Ali, part of the documentary Preventive Warriors, which is produced by Michael Burns and Greg Anson. This is Democracy Now!, and you can get more information at preventivewarriors.com. We'll be premiering the entire documentary on Monday, a Memorial Day special here on Democracy Now!, and that does it for the program. Looking forward to seeing people tonight at 6:30 in Loch Sheldrake, New York, at the Sullivan County Community College Selig Theater, celebrating WJFF as we continue our Exception to the Rulers book and media tour. Tomorrow night at Telluride, Colorado, at the 26th Annual Mountain Film Festival. That's Friday night and Saturday morning. On Saturday, a benefit for KVNF in Paonia, Colorado, the Paradise Theater. Looking forward to seeing folks there. And on Sunday, a benefit for KRZA, Community Radio, in Taos. We'll be at the Rio Grande Hall, Taos Convention Center at 120 Civic Plaza Drive in Taos, New Mexico, as we continue our Exception to the Rulers tour. And if you go to our website at democracynow.org, we've put up a chapter of the book called Lies of Our Times, that chronicles how the New York Times coverage of Iraq helped pave the way for war. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill. Our website, democracynow.org, if you'd like to get a copy of the program today, 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
With never a reason why, and a toast of the wine.